I'm delighted to have been asked to speak on St. Therese. I know it sounds unbelievable that in 1939 I entered the seminary, because I look so much younger than that. But back in 1939, I entered the seminary in Yonkers, and there was a priest there named Father John Middleton. And he had the custom each year of giving a seminar once a week to the new fellows who came in, to the new class, the first philosophy class. And his seminar was simply an orientation course on the spirituality of the seminary, trying to break you in and get you used to the whole idea of the spiritual life that was expected of you. He recommended the reading of the autobiography of Saint Therese of Lisieux, The Story of a Soul. And I started to read the book, and I couldn't believe how she was so obviously the saint for me. No saint has ever really grabbed me by the scruff of the neck, taken hold of me and held my interest as she did. It was as though she were reading my mail. She seemed to know what was going on inside of me. She seemed to know my needs, my neuroses, my insecurities, my lack of being sure enough of myself to take myself seriously, my doubt that I could ever be pleasing to God. You know what I mean? And somehow or other, she just made me feel at home in the world of God, in the world of prayer, in the world of meditation, and so forth. Well, I never got over her. All through the years of my priesthood, all during the seminary, and especially in more recent years, I've just become more and more deeply interested in her. I don't know how many times I have read her autobiography, maybe 10, maybe 15 times in the course of the years, maybe not all the way through each time, but going back to pieces of it. I've read it slowly, a page in a day, 2 pages in a day maybe, reflectively. And I thought when I first read it that I understood it, and I did understand it. You know, I had no trouble in understanding what she was saying, but the 10th time you read it, you feel as though you never read it before. I mean, it is everlastingly new. It's like the Bible. You read it again and again, and each time you read it, you go down deeper, and you say, my God, what an unbelievably profound mystic Saint Therese of Lisieux is. She's a deep sea diver. She goes all the way down to the bottom of the mystery of God. She knows God. She is sure of God. She knows what God's weakness is. His weakness is us. He can't resist us. His weakness is mercy. St. John said in his first letter, God is love. And that is the ultimate revelation of who God is. God is love, and God is nothing but love. But Therese nuanced that a little bit further when she said, God is merciful love. And that is a little bit of a distinction, because what I need is merciful love. And if you're anything at all like me, I would suspect you need it too. Possibly, however, you don't. Possibly you are not a sinner. Possibly. But hardly, probably. We are all so desperately in need of God's merciful love. Now, over the years, that has become more and more clear to me that Therese is, now I will say exaggerated things. I'm Irish, and the Irish are always using exaggeration. But I'm not saying these things on my own. I say them out of a really wide reading of some very, very wonderful scholars. Therese was called by Pope Pius XI the greatest saint of modern times, and he said that about 10 years before she was canonized. The greatest saint of modern times. No, it was Pius X, excuse me. By the time she was canonized, he was dead. But he had already, in that statement, canonized her. It is impossible to overstate the dimensions of her holiness. They are now comparing her, for instance, to St. Paul, saying that her experience of God was very much the same kind of experience that he had and the same depth of experience that he had. Cardinal von Balthasar, who died just a couple of years ago, and who himself has been called the most cultured man of the modern age. That's quite an encomium. There was nothing that Balthasar didn't know. He could sit down at the piano without music and play all the works of Mozart straight through. He read in widely and wrote widely in scripture, speculative theology, psychology, moral theology, church history. He was the Renaissance man of our times, and he wrote a book called The Mission of St. Therese of Lisieux, and in that book, he compares her mission in importance to the mission of St. Paul. Balthasar says that just as God raised up Saul of Tarsus and singularly graced him to proclaim the gospel to the Gentiles, so he reached down and he raised up Therese of Lisieux and singularly graced her to proclaim to our darkened, frightened, anxiety-laden 20th century the beautiful and joyful gospel of his merciful love. That is a tremendous word of praise from a man who knows what he's talking about. I couldn't carry Balthasar's book bag, you know what I mean? I'm not a scholar, but I depend on some really fine works of scholarship to back up the things that I would say. The one point that I would like to make today is you really owe it to yourself to read The Story of a Soul. Many of you have already read it, but read it again. And then set it aside for a few months and read it again. And then let some time go by and reread it. Keep on going back to it, because it's like the scriptures. The Story of the Soul, her autobiography, there's no bottom to it. You just keep going down and down, and she introduces you into a profound sense of the mystery of God's mercy. I would recommend that you use Father John Clark's translation. It's probably the best English translation, and it has a marvelous introduction by Father John Clark in which he explains how the autobiography came to be written. It was not written as a single book, but as three reflections or memoirs. You know, I suppose, that her three sisters were nuns with her in the Carmel of Lisieux, and so was a cousin, a first cousin, Marie Guérin. So there were five from the same family, and that was absolutely in violation of the rule of the great Saint Teresa of Avila, who said there can be no more than three from the same family, because obviously it could cause all kinds of jealousy and clannishness and all the rest of it. So she very wisely made that rule, but an exception was made for this most exceptional family from Lisieux by the name of Martin, or as we would say in English, Martin. John Clark will explain in his introduction that manuscript A, there's manuscript A, manuscript B, manuscript C, and they're all put together, and they are called The Story of a Soul, or The Autobiography of St. Therese. He explains that manuscript A originated in the following manner. One night, the sisters were gathered around the fire in the Carmel of Lisieux at recreation. And Marie said to Pauline, who was the mother prioress of the monastery, Therese really should write down the reminiscences of her childhood for us, for the family. She has so many charming and wonderful memories, and she recounts them so well. Really, she should write them down. And Therese laughed. She thought Marie was kidding. And Marie insisted. She said, no, you really should do that. And finally, Marie said to Pauline, you're the mother prioress. Tell her that she must do it. And Pauline said, okay, I command you to do it. Now, that's how manuscript A, which I suppose is about 115 pages or so, that's how it came about, at the command of Pauline. You might be interested to know that Therese worked on it for a few months. She didn't have much time. She might have 10 minutes one day and 20 minutes another day and no minutes the following day. But she never lost the continuity of it. She never erased or scratched out a single word. She picked up and continued where she left off the day before, and it hangs together perfectly, and it is the most charming piece of writing that you will encounter. It really, the style is not great. I mean, she's no William Shakespeare, but she's no slouch. She writes very well, especially when she is recounting stories, and particularly also when she's describing, for instance, the beauties of nature. When she talks about a blue sky, you can see the blue sky. When she talks about the ocean, sitting by the seashore in Trouville, where the family used to go on vacation, you can just see the sun hitting the water, and her imagination is marvelous. It's easy reading, and it is delightful reading. Amazing that she would be able to do that. She had extraordinary gifts. Extraordinary gifts. She once wrote a poem, To Live by Love. And it had a very good verse. I mean, the meter and the rhyme in the French is truly excellent. Not, you know, it's not Dante. It's not great literature in that sense, but very creditable verse writing. She wrote that in the silence of the chapel during 40 hours devotion in the convent without writing a thing down. It's 124 verses. And she went out and she wrote it all out, having composed it in her head. She really was remarkably gifted in this respect. You'll be interested to know, I started to say before, that when she finished Manuscript A, she dutifully gave it to Pauline, the mother prioress, and Pauline put it in a drawer and never looked at it for 3 months. And Therese never asked, "What do you think of it?" or "Could I have your reaction?" She had perfect control of her human curiosity. Manuscript B is only about 12 or 14 pages, and that's the heart and center of the autobiography. People say that it ranks with the finest writing in all spiritual literature. That is the gem that is set in the center. Now, that is simply two letters that she wrote, and they just put them in as part of the autobiography. Two letters that she wrote to her older sister, Marie, on her retreat in 1896. She was making a private retreat, and it was customary to send notes back and forth. And Marie said to her, "Would you explain to me in plain and simple writing and very briefly, what is this little way that you are talking about?" And Therese's answer, where she rises really to the heights of mysticism and profound spirituality, is that answer becomes Manuscript B. And that's the very jewel, as I say, set in the middle of the autobiography. Manuscript C, meanwhile, Pauline went out of office, and Mother Gonzague, who had been the prioress, came back as the prioress again. And Pauline said to her one day, "You know, you really should make Therese write down her convent experiences." Manuscript A were her childhood experiences. You see the difference when you read. And so Mother Gonzague gave her that command to do it under obedience, and that took her a few months, and she wrote down, and Manuscript C is also a magnificent thing. Now, that's how the whole thing came about, so simply. So simply. You know, no great effort. She just wrote out of the abundance of her heart. It was published. She died on September 30th, 1897. And the autobiography, somewhat cut and doctored a little bit, but basically what she had done. Now we have the actual word by word of Therese in the definitive edition. Then it was somewhat, as I say, altered, but it came out exactly 1 year after she died. She died September 30th, 1897. September 30th, 1898, the first edition was published. There were 1,000 copies. It sold out immediately. They produced 4,000 copies. They sold out immediately. It began to be translated. It has been translated into 100 different languages. And only God can count the millions upon millions of copies that have been made and sold. And, of course, the countless millions more who have read it, because it's been in libraries and it has been taken out and read by many people. Anybody who ever read it will always give it to a friend and say, "You really have to read this." And the friend will give it to another friend, and so the book has an enormous circulation. I would have to guess that aside from the Bible and the Koran, it is the bestseller of all religious works. Now, somebody could contradict that, but if it is not, it certainly is third or fourth. It's all over the world, and it is read by just nobody knows how many millions of people. Now, what is the secret? What is the attraction? What is the secret of this amazing girl who died at the age of 24, an unknown sister, in a Carmelite cloister, in the province of Normandy in France, 3 years before the last century ended. What is the amazing secret? She never did anything exceptional. She wrote a very exceptional autobiography, of course, but aside from that, she was not known. One of the sisters, when she died, they have the custom of sending around a little necrology of a sister to the various Carmels. And one of the sisters said to one of the others, "What are we going to write about Therese? She really has never done anything exceptional." Well, she really did something very exceptional. She came to know the one true God as the one true God really is. What is the secret? That is such a hard question to answer. But the closest I could come to answering it is to say, the little way is for little people. And the world is full of little people. She said, "I have nothing to say to great souls. What I have to say is for little souls." So a poor 19-year-old kid goes into the seminary and he picks the book up and he says, "This woman is speaking to me." He doesn't know. The reason he's saying that is because she's a little soul and he's a little soul. I'll be accused of many things in my life. I will never be accused of being great. It couldn't happen. Nobody could ever think of me as great. They might like me. They might dislike me. But the last thing they would ever say is, "He is a great human individual." I'm not. I'm guessing, but I think you're not. And what we long for is one of our own kind. One of our own kind. And she's our own kind. She went through everything that we have gone through, and virtually nothing that we have not gone through. She never had a vision. She never had an ecstasy, except once when she was making the Stations of the Cross. She had a very, very powerful, powerful experience of God's love. And she walked around on cloud nine for about a week. She said, "I feel as though somebody gave me another body. I don't feel as if I'm in my own body." You know, that lasted a week. Okay. That has never happened to me, and that will not happen to you. So that's by way of exception. But apart from that, no visions, no dialogues with Jesus, the way, for example, St. Gertrude had. Jesus spoke to St. Gertrude. He never spoke to St. Therese. As a matter of fact, he was extraordinarily silent in her presence. Her experience of religious life for 9 years was an experience of total dryness, aridity. She fell asleep when she tried to pray. She said, "He's hiding from me." Prayer was like talking to a stone wall. And she just laughed. She said, "He's hiding from me. If he wants to hide from me, that's fine. Let him do whatever he wants. I don't want to upset him." She was known for her amazingly radiant smile. And she kept a pleasant look on her face, even when she was alone in her cell, because she said, "I don't want Jesus to notice that anything is
upsetting me or that I'm experiencing any pain. He has enough trouble of his own without my adding to it. I mean, that's beautiful. That's simply, that's what you call real love. She hid her suffering from Jesus. And she said, if he wants to hide from me, that's all right with me. I'll love him just the same, whether I feel his presence or whether I feel his absence. It's all the same to me. And she added, he will more quickly get tired of making me wait for him than I will get tired of waiting. She had his number. She had God's number. She really knew God. I think that is the secret, is that it was all so ordinary. She found him everywhere. She said once, I think since the age of 3 1/2, I have never been 5 minutes without thinking about God. You know, totally, totally recollected. In those days, the Carmelites wore a very long veil, which they threw down over their face. So, you know, it was a life of enclosed solitude and reflection. They would throw their veils up for recreation period and so forth, but normally in the course of the day they would walk around with eyes downcast. That was the custom in those days. It was part of the psychology of the monastic movement. And there was a gardener who worked in the place, and of course one looked just like the other. They, you know, you wouldn't know them apart. They were all under this lot of clothing. And he said you could always tell when she walked by because you could feel her recollection. Through the clothes, it came out. Her bearing, she stood very straight. She was fairly tall, I think 5'7 1/2" or so. She was the tallest of all her sisters. And she had a regal bearing to her. And even all that clothing and so forth could not hide it. You just sensed her amazing closeness to God. Another secret, I think, why she is so attractive to us is the simplicity of her style. She writes with the plainest style. You know, there's nothing complex about it. She never strives for effect. Never. She's totally unconscious of her style. She just writes the way she said, I write whatever comes out of my pen. I wish I could write that way. You know, you go through agonies trying to put a talk together or write an essay or whatever. She just wrote it as it flowed out of her pen. She talked to the pen, and the pen talked to the paper, and the paper talks to us when we go to read it. The secret of her tremendous charm for us is her emphasis on the merciful love of God. Oh, that's what we all so much need to hear. That he loves us as we are. Not as we might be if we tried harder. Not as we would be if we had made a greater effort all through the past. He loves us as we are. And when you stop to think of it, if he doesn't love me as I am, then how could he ever love me? I mean, what could I possibly do to persuade God to love me if he doesn't love me now? He doesn't love me because of me. He loves me because of him. He loves me because he is love. He loves me because he can't stop loving me, because he wouldn't be God if he stopped loving me. Because God is love. And specifically, God is merciful love. Now, she had this profound, profound sense of that.
And that is the message that we all, I think, want to hear. Her slogan was confidence, nothing but confidence. La confiance, rien que la confiance. She fairly shouted it. Once, one of her sisters, in the last part of her life, when she had suffered terribly through tuberculosis and through a trial of fate that lasted 18 months until the moment of her death, for 18 months, God was blocked out. No sense, no feeling of his presence. She went on smiling. She went on joking. She went on doing her imitations. She was a fantastic mimic. She went on making the crazy puns that she used to enjoy making and keeping everybody in the infirmary laughing. And her sister said to her one day, "It's amazing how patiently you suffer and what virtue you have attained." And with great impatience, Therese said to her, "Oh, it's not that. You always misunderstand me. Our good works condemn us if we rely upon them. Our good works condemn us if we rely upon them." That's why the Pharisee was condemned. He said, "I pay tithes on all my income. I fast twice in the week. I do this, I do that. Therefore, God must love me." He had it all wrong. The publican had it right, who just said, "Oh God, be merciful to me, a sinner." And Jesus says he went home to his house justified. Therese had that deep, deep understanding of that. So she said, "What pleases God in me is not my good works. What pleases him is when he sees me loving my littleness." By which she means loving my powerlessness, loving my lack of virtue, loving my weakness, loving my inability to keep resolutions perfectly, loving me when I'm impatient and say something cross and then regret it and go through all sorts of self-recrimination afterwards. And then she would say, "That is suffering which he sends me out of love, and I joyfully and gladly accept it." This is the great, great secret. And if we can learn it, we will be wonderfully happy people. It's the secret of self-acceptance. Not for psychological reasons, not by a sort of self-help pop psychology, but for theological reasons. Because it is based completely on God and on God's love for us. Well, it's a long time since 1939, in case you haven't noticed. And what do you suppose happened to me on New Year's Eve this year? I went to leisure. And I spent 5 marvelous days there. I'm trying to write a book on Therese. It's about Therese and a young fellow with whom she exchanged 22 letters, Maurice Belliere. And it's a very interesting story, and I hope I will get it finished soon. I think I'm toward the end of it. But I wanted to go over and visit the locale of certain things that happen in the book, because when you're writing about places, you want to have seen them. Well, Bishop Gaucher, who's the auxiliary bishop of Lisieux, gave me 3.5 days of his time and drove me all over Normandy, here and there. And he's one of the world's great experts on Therese. Anyway, I just had the most wonderful experience of Lisieux. that night, that was New Year's Eve, I was invited, and so was Bishop Gaucher, to make a holy hour at midnight with the sisters in the Carmel. And I went in there. I was jet-lagged and really, really fatigued. And I was sitting up front, and of course, I did what she did. I fell asleep, you know. I said, my God, here I am, you know. My one and only chance to be here. And I fall asleep. But anyway, there was that. I went to Alençon, where she was born. Now, that would be maybe 60, 70 miles from Lisieux. And I'm standing looking into the bedroom where she was born. And all of a sudden, I said, my God, it's January 2nd, her birthday. Her 120th birthday. I mean, it hit me. I didn't plan that. I didn't know that I was going on her birthday, you know. It just seemed to me such an extraordinary favor from her that I should have had that experience. I said Mass in the Carmel on the day she was baptized, January 4th. I preached to the sisters in French. Can you imagine? I wrote it out the night before in about 15 minutes. God only knows how many mistakes are in it, you know. But I had no trouble to give it and no nervousness at all. And you know what one of the sisters did? She said, give me that copy you have there, and I'll Xerox it for you. And I'll put this one under Teresa's pillow. Ooh. It's probably still there. My talk is under Teresa's pillow, where she died, you know. Incredible little things, signs of her affection, just the most wonderful visit. What did I preach about? I said, just very briefly, I said to the sisters, I want, first of all, to be able to go back home and tell everyone in New York I gave you a sermon in French. And then, secondly, I want to tell you about the grace that I have received here in Lisieux. I think a very exceptional grace, and I can't tell you when I got it. It just came to me gradually over the 5 days that I spent there. And this is the grace. All my life, since 1939 anyway, I have really, I think, best I know, loved Therese. I have kept my interest in her. I have talked about her. I have praised her. I have tried to tell the world what a completely, uniquely, uniquely exceptional event she is. Person she is. I've done all this. I'm trying to write a book about her, etc., etc., etc. But way down underneath, I've always been nagged by the feeling, you talk about her, you sing her praises, but you don't imitate her. You don't really follow the little way. You don't do everything from morning to night with the fidelity to grace that she did. So you're really not pleasing to her, and you're really not pleasing to God. That's a lousy feeling, you know? And you know what the grace was? The grace was as if Therese said to me, look, that's exactly what I'm fighting against. You're trying to measure yourself. Don't measure yourself. You want to know how you stand with God. Don't ask how you stand with God. Let Him decide how you stand. Let Him judge you. Let Him count your merits and your demerits and do all the addition and subtraction and all the rest. Don't do it yourself. Just trust Him. Rien que la confiance. Nothing but trust, blind trust, and put all that preoccupation with yourself and how well you're doing and how well you live the little way, etc., etc., etc. Put all that out of your mind and simply trust Him.
Now, I said to the sisters, that, I think, is an extraordinary grace, to get that as if she gave me a message. When the nun said, I'm going to put it under her pillow, that capped the climax, you know. That was as though the seal of approval was placed upon it. Don't worry about how good you are or how bad you are. You know, that's not the point. The point is how good God is and how he is going to love us, and whatever we've done, he will forgive us. All we have to do is trust him. All we have to do is, you know what she said? She said, if I committed all the sins of the entire human race, from the first that was ever committed by Adam and Eve to the last one of history, it would make no difference to me. I would still trust in his merciful love. I think that's the message. And sweethearts, if you get it, it's the greatest message you could ever hear. May God give you the grace to understand it.